Fanning on 2FM.
Now, Ben Watt is best known as the male half of Everything But the Girl, a duo whose career spanned the years 82 to 2002. Since then, he and wife Tracy Thorne have been raising their kids in London. He's been DJing, she's been doing solo work, oh yeah, and they've been writing the odd book as well. Romany and Tom is Ben's second effort. The first, Patient, detailed his battle with serious illness and his reflections on his life. The second is no less personal, but focuses primarily on the lives of his parents, Romany and Tom. The book opens with the rather stark lines, we only see the second half of our parents' lives, the downhill part, the golden years we have to piece together. It's a tale of frustrated ambition, anger, depression, love. It's perhaps as messy and as complicated as most adult relationships, though it's chronicled with an admirable frankness and honesty, and it's brilliantly written. And Ben Watt joins me now. Firstly, Ben, having said all that, can I go one step further? You must be pleased with the way the book has been received, because it's been pretty damn ecstatic.
Of course, you know, you always hope that people are going to like what you do and you're making some kind of connection with people. So, yeah, it's very gratifying.
Okay, that opening phrase that I used there, the quote, it seems so obviously obvious, but it's absolutely starkly brilliant as well. I mean, the downhill years of our parents' existence, people don't often necessarily think about that, that kids really do only know part two, and they can only read about or find out about with a bit of luck if, in your case, for instance, there are your mother's letters and things, which is pretty damn handy, frankly. It's just like, you just don't know, do you?
No, it's true. I mean, I think, you know, as soon as we become aware of our parents, when we're perhaps, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, yeah. They're in their 30s, possibly their 40s, and you're right, a large part of their life has disappeared. And, you know, in many cases, that may well have been the best bit, and we didn't find out about it. And certainly, you know, during my growing up, I can look back and think that I was aware of my dad in his 50s when he was, you know, raging a little bit about a lost career, and I can remember the fortitude of my mum, and I can remember them rallying in their 60s and having a very good, quite poignant 6 or 7 years out of London. And then, of course, you know, towards the end, frailty, you know, resignation, 70s.
And the end is where the whole book starts, frankly, yeah. back 2006 direction. Like, you know, there is the thing about, you know, people know when they're grown up, when they have a kid, or when they have to stop this nonsense of second and third and fourth level education, I better go out and get a job and join the workforce. Or, in your case, when you realise that they realise that you are now the adult in the family. Mm. And that was a 2002 moment, and before as well.
Well, there is that moment when responsibility is finally handed over.
Yeah.
And, you know, my dad said to me quite clearly at one point, I defer to you now. And I realised that the baton was being passed in my direction. And I think it's something that we all have to confront. But what you're left with is not quite what you expect. And a lot of the time it was like dealing with two truculent children, you know.
Of course.
It's a tricky time, and it throws up a lot of issues, obviously.
Okay, well, then let's go back. I just mentioned earlier on that you had a book before this, Patient. It was a hit when it was published back in 1996, and you took a long time to do something about your parents. Why the long gap?
I think I felt I had a story to tell with Patient, and once it was told, I didn't have another story to tell, I suppose. And, you know, I've always filled my life with lots of different things that have often been perhaps a reaction to what I've done before. I'm always looking for a new challenge, a new set of tools, if you like, with which to express what I want to say. And I think I felt recently, having spent 10 years out of the mainstream, working on the underground, running an electronic music label, being a DJ, that I had a need to get back to words again. That was very important to me. But where that came from, I'm not sure. It was an instinct of some kind. And that kick-started the book. And yes, it's been a long time, but...
And one of the things that might have kick-started the book as well, that your half-brother Rowley gave you a box of souvenirs and the idea flared up to do this kind of thing, is there's plenty of poring over the keepsakes of your parents, and you write about, in one way, your lack of interest in them growing up. Not so much really lack of interest, maybe that's a bit unfair, but just that's a natural way of late teens into 20s, into 30s, that we all do,
yeah,
to a point. Do you feel in any way at all that therefore there's something cathartic about this, that you've kind of evened the score, that you feel you had it, like that you feel, okay, now I've done them the pride that they would want me to have done?
It's funny. I mean, the relationship with your parents is very complicated, and I think we are encouraged from very early on to somehow see them in a heroic light. You know, they're very iconic. You know, we grew up with phrases like honouring your parents, they would be proud of you, showing respect. But I think what I discovered writing the book and doing all the research was just the human scale of their lives. And I felt that I actually got closer to them writing the book by realising how flawed they were.
Of course.
And that was really, I think, how I seemed to grow to love them more, just by the fact that they were just as messed up about life as I was. And it doesn't matter whether you're 20 or 40 or 60 or 80, you are just battling all the time with, you know, your own issues, your own demons, your own...
Yeah, but when you look through life's rich pageant of anybody, your parents had something pretty special in so many ways. I mean, there was a grandparent there who would have inspired, what do you call him, Attenborough on TV to do his kind of, I don't know, the kind of programmes that he does now. There was a little bit of something, there was a frisson of excitement, let's say, right there through. Then your own parents. There was your dad, who was a band leader, who was a great jazz... Well, I mean, a biggish jazz person. He won an Ivor Novello Award in the 50s. He was on the cover of Melody Maker. But you know, you can point to certain things that being right, that guy made it. Your mum even more so, like flying to Mexico to interview Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, or hanging out with Goldie Hawn, or whatever the hell it happens to be. And when things didn't work out after, it's a long way downhill for your parents, and they don't work out later on in life. Those things just become memories. So in one way, bigger highs, you know, deeper lows.
Well, that's very true. And certainly for my dad, when I look back on it, I mean, his golden period was incredibly short. I mean, really, 1957 to perhaps 1962 was his heyday as a London band leader.
Yeah.
He had an album deal with George Martin at Parlophone. He had his own show on the BBC. He was the youngest band leader in London at Quaglino's in the late 50s. He was definitely, you know, riding the wave.
Yeah.
But he was barged into the past by rock and roll. And ensemble, big band jazz, didn't have a role to play anymore. And he took it very badly. You know, he could have acquiesced, like some of his peers, and moved into pop arranging or into light entertainment.
Which he did a bit of.
He tried it occasionally, but he didn't want to. He was famously offered the job very early on of arranging for the Beatles.
Yeah.
And turned it down because he just didn't like the music. So, you're right. I mean, it's difficult when that's what you live for and it only fills 5 years of your life. What do you do next?
And what he did next was become a decorator, and like little things like, you know, Honor Blackman would come on the telly and he would say, look, there's your woman, Honor Blackman. You did a great job on her downstairs loo.
That's right.
I mean, like, there's a sort of a, like, irony of, like, you just accept it all. But after a while, it just doesn't get very good, does it?
I think he battled with moving out of jazz for about 10 years. And then the early 70s came along and he realised that it really was over.
Yeah.
He'd grown up, he was a working class Glasgow boy. You know, his father had been a foreman in the local factory. He'd come home and had been lectured, you know, with Christian socialism and a very sort of moral outlook of probity and godliness. And I think my dad felt that if he were to do anything, he had to return to the life of a working man, perhaps. I think he saw that as an honest way out, to use his oft-used word, honest. Own up, he always used to say. So for him, I think becoming a painter and a decorator was an appropriate exit for him, really.
Right. Can I just ask, which is not anything to do with the book, but just on that level of what you think in terms of music, since you had huge success. You were here in this damn studio with me more than 25 years ago with Tracy Thorne. And in fact, we spoke to Tracy only 6 months ago on the programme with her book. And like, if you think about the jazz era being, as you call it, barged out of the system completely, by rock and roll. And you mentioned 62 there, which ironically, of course, is when the Beatles hit big. So that was the end of his time. Do you think in some ways that when people play jazz these days, they play the great jazz mostly, anyway, of the 40s and 50s, or the 30s, 40s and 50s. When people play classical music these days, it's still Brahms, Beethoven, Bach, etc. When you listen to classic rock radio now, I don't think many of the songs will be that different than they will be in 30 or 40 years' time. What I'm trying to say is, do you think the whole rock thing is kind of going the way of what I've just mentioned there in terms of classical and jazz?
Well, there's certainly a language that gets repeated. And, you know, we are looking to the past to make the present and the future always. And certainly, you know, the leaps forward that were made in the 60s and the 70s when rock was in its infancy will never be repeated. I mean, there is only a 14-year gap between the Beatles and the Sex Pistols, which is, you know, if you go back 14 years from now, to the year 2000 and you try and think of anything important that's happened in music, it's quite hard to come up with anything as important as the Beatles and the Sex Pistols in rock and roll terms. But that doesn't mean to say that it has any less value. You know, books are still being written and they're just made up of words.
Yeah.
You know, so rock music is still being made and it's still made up of rock music.
Yeah.
You know, it was Auden who said, you know, poetry is made of poems. So we are always, you know, reinventing the past in some way, bolting it together in a different way.
Yeah, I could stay here all day arguing with you. No, I don't necessarily just mean the music. I actually mean the whole culture that goes with kind of rock, which is kind of dying or whatever. And maybe it was just an album time of 12 inches of vinyl or whatever. And anyway, look, there is one thing to say, just staying with music for a second there, that you have a description in the book here of music and club culture and that, of which you've been part of and are still part of, I presume, are you?
Yeah. It's on the back burner at the moment.
Right, okay. And you say it's a ritual where the room is bigger than any one individual within it. That's club culture for you, just in terms of what happens there. Would that be a good little one-sentence description for family?
It's certainly one way of looking at it. It was something that was picked out in one of the reviews of the book.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Recently. Yes, I mean, possibly it's true, you know, the family as a clubbing experience. I don't know, maybe slightly stretched.
Okay, slightly stretched. But I mean, let's just get to some other details then of that. Like the drinking and the pubs, a constant motif in your childhood. Is this a source of anger?
A source of anger?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
You were never angry with your dad for relying, and there was a lot of reliance on drink a lot of the time.
Well, certainly, you know, when I look back, I say in the book how the times, you know, the photographs of him that seem to mean the most to me now when I look back are the ones in which I realised that he was sober. So, yes, I suppose it was an issue for me. And I think I foolishly believed for too long in my adult years that by berating him in some way or by picking him up on his habits that he could somehow change, not only improve his own life but improve his relationship with my mum at times, which had deteriorated.
Yeah.
You know, and his relationship with me. But, you know, it's like taking a horse to water, isn't it?
Well, then there are certain parts where you might think, or a certain age that you might have been, where you said, and I'll just give you this here, about transforming your parents into well-rounded, contented members of the imaginary happy middle classes. In other words, the grass is always greener somewhere else, or things are often better, or something like that. They're not, though, are they?
I think it was a feeling that struck me when I was carving out an adult life of my own.
And they were supposed to be becoming happy grandparents.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's an illusion, but, you know, we all live in hope. And they had very successfully extricated themselves from a very dark period in the family house in London. And much to everyone's surprise, had started afresh in Oxford in their 60s and made a very good fist of it. And I was very proud of them for that. It was quite poignant the way that
in Oxford they would have been more bohemian than bourgeoisie types, I presume.
Not particularly. I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, people have been saying the last couple of weeks, oh, you know, your parents seem so glamorous, they seem so bohemian.
Yeah.
But you know, they came from quite Spartan backgrounds. You know, my father grew up
Working class Glasgow, whatever.
Yeah, and my mother grew up, you know, with a Methodist background. So there was never any excess in the house. Yes, they did interesting jobs and worked in the media and stuff, but you know, it wasn't just like, you know, caftans and floorboards and bare feet and bottles of red wine rolling around, you know.
No. So. Well, now that you're back to the drink again, I might as well mention, I mean, like, there was drinking and disappointment and frustrations, and there are those who would say, this sounds like a Mike Leigh film, and frankly, it kind of does in some ways. You say at one stage that health becomes like a pressing concern in old age. You reflect on the cycle of broken promises and good intentions, and you say, the history of my adult relationship with them was benchmarked with promises of abstinence. They let you down. And that this is going to sound like a Philip Larkin poem now if I keep going here. But they do. You know, in fact, Philip Larkin, that's the reason you went to university, isn't it? Because he was the librarian there.
One of the reasons, yeah.
In Hull. Mm. Yeah. And did you enjoy your time there? Sorry, I'm getting away from the question I was asking you there. The frustrations. I mean, like, your parents can only be your parents, and you let them off the hook in some ways here. But they did let you down in some ways.
I think I'll go back to what I said earlier on, which is that I feel I feel that I had to see them from their perspective as well, not just mine. I thought that was the fair way to see it.
Yeah.
That, you know, they are riven with their own issues and problems. And it's very easy to sit here and say, I was let down by my parents. You know, they were let down by people themselves and had to deal with it. And I think that the point of the book is that we are all the same. In that sense, there's no blame to be attached here. You know, it was very true that the baton, you know, was passed to me, and that it was very complicated. It wasn't just a question of getting them to hospital visits.
And what about the hospitals and the wards and the care homes? Was it in any way easier for you, or does this sound like a glib thing to say? I mean, in that, like, you know, they're very off-putting places, but because I mentioned earlier on about your other book, Patient, you were inured to it all, if you like, through personal experience. Something of an advantage, possibly?
Definitely.
Right.
You know, they weren't frightening places to go. I think a lot of people can't wait to get out of hospitals as soon as they step inside them. I'm not saying they're my favourite places to be, but I know how they work. And I think that's one thing we are never taught. We are never taught the routines of hospitals. And we walk in and we don't know when doctors and consultants will walk round and give us information. We don't know that young nurses aren't privy to information that's going to help us understand what's going on. These things I learned when I was in hospital myself. You have to learn the routines. You have to learn the schedules of hospitals. And that was... that helped a lot with, you know, my parents and the visits that they had to pay. When I was writing Patient, I sent a first draft, an early draft, to a doctor who used to write in the Observer newspaper called John Colley, who I also knew he wrote novels. And I really liked his writing style. And I sent it to him partly to have a look at the hospital language and the way I described hospitals and to almost give me, you know, an idea of whether I was writing in the right way, but also just to give me any writing tips on the book. And one of the things he pointed out to me was to strip out the sentimentality. And at that point, I had more of my own emotions in the book. And I feel very strongly when you write that that's what you need to take away. You just need to find a good story and tell it as plainly as you can, because it's the reader's feelings that matter, not mine.
Well, it is melancholic, it is edgy, it's nostalgic, it's not sad, it's not maudlin. Were you aware of, like, not falling into traps? Is that what you're saying, in so many ways? Like, just tell it like it is.
Well, like I say, it's trying to avoid the sentimentality. And, you know, when you're writing about your parents, you know, we've talked about these sort of phrases that hang over you, like honouring your parents, respecting your parents, doing right by them. I felt I had to get away from the parent relationship and just describe us all as people going through these experiences.
Your mom, when she was interviewing people, used to bring you back autographs, and, you know, you didn't care really. Noel Edmonds, James Galway. You have one from Wings to Ben. Love from Linda and hubby Paul. Do you still have it?
I do. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So have you kept a box like your mother then?
No, but I've kept that photograph.
Oh, it's a photograph. Yeah. Oh, right.
Signed right. Photograph.
Oh, very good. Oh, excuse me. That's probably worth something, all right. Everything But the Girl, when that ceased in 2002, you became the DJ. Those gigs and the music reflected the way you really felt inside, did they? I mean, is that one way of looking at the, what you were doing then as a DJ?
There was a period where, I mean, I talk about it in the book, where I started to suffer badly from depression. I mean, it's something that's plagued me on and off since my 20s.
And at one stage, your dad puts your arm around you and says, I know.
Yeah.
Which speaks volumes.
Yeah.
Because he did too.
Well, yes. I mean, our whole family has had its ups and downs with depression. I mean, I talk about it in the book, how family members have been plagued by it at one point. And it's certainly something that affects me. And I didn't really deal with it until I was in my 40s. But when I was going through a bad period, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, I did find that club music was strangely soothing in its intensity. It was, you know, the whole club experience seemed an appropriate form of music to be playing at the time. Wordless and kind of sonically aggressive seemed quite suitable at the time.
And was it quite suitable and quite great, or is it just a thing that when your father's death resulted in obituaries being written in the broadsheet press? I mean, like, you know, the Times, the Independent, the Guardian, the Jazz Writer, they all featured him in the obits. That nice?
Well, it was, but it's partly because I chased them down.
Yeah, I know
them.
That, yeah.
You know, I felt in some way that, you know, I needed him to be recognised.
Yeah.
I felt he'd, you know, kind of missed out in some way. So, you know, I called a couple of the jazz writers up at the broadsheets and asked if they'd be interested in writing about him. I actually thought they'd turn around and go, no. But I was surprised when they were willing to write about him.
Okay, well, you're not willing to come back with Everything But the Girl, but I mean, music-wise, the music you make, is Tracy Thorn, as in your wife, a sounding board for the solo material, or do you do all that separate?
I think we've always been like that for each other. I mean, people know that we've lived privately and publicly for over 30 years, but we've always written in isolation, even back in the days of Everything But the Girl. We're not the kind of couple who sit around the piano like Goffin and King or Lieber and Stoller, you know.
You don't clock in at 9 and go out at 5 and have a drink and talk about the songs you wrote that afternoon.
No Brill Building.
The Brill Building, yeah.
So we do tend to write in isolation, and we've carried that through into our books as well as, you know, our songs. But I think we do value, as you say, each other's editorial skills, and, you know, they're a first point of contact when a set of ideas are perhaps first formalised, you know, to see what reaction we get. So we value each other's input, definitely.
Okay, finally, Ben, just, you know, do you think because of the way you saw your parents, and you talk particularly about the second half as opposed to the first, and you'd like to have seen more of the first rather than just garner it through a lot of the letters, etc. Do you think in any way at all that you have a kind of a plan to try to be, and I, the minute I say this, it damns the parents, a better, sorry, parent than your mum and dad? Is that very unfair?
I think they were great parents in many ways, and they were difficult parents in many ways. Yeah. And I think we are all that, if we're honest. I think I am probably just as self-absorbed and narcissistic as they were about certain things in my life. And I have to, you know, prick myself from time to time and say, you know, get out from behind the studio, get out from behind the laptop, engage with the kids. And, you know, I think we are very much a society that's wrapped up in ourselves at the moment.
Mm.
Modern screens, Twitter, internet has made us all much more narcissistic than we were. And I see it in my own kids. You know, they're absolutely wrapped up in their own lives. Spend like
all bent over looking at a little thing in their
hand. Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
So I do think there has never been a better time for face-to-face contact. And I constantly remind myself and, you know, the family that it's needed. Don't always make it happen, but it's an important part of family life, I think.
All right, well, listen, Ben, thank you very much indeed for dropping in to talk to us on the programme. Romany and Tom is the name of the book. In other words, your parents' names. It's by Ben Watt. It's Bloomsbury, am I right? Bloomsbury Circus, yeah, indeed. And it's out now at the moment. And it really is a great read. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.